Police Academy is your source for the no apologies, no spin truth about all things police. Discussions about why cops do what they do, avoiding speeding tickets, or just how to stay alive can all be found right here. No questions out of bounds, no topic too sensitive. This is Police Academy. Do you understand
the words that are coming out of my mouth? What we're dealing with here, glittering air, is a complete lack of respect for the law.
And smoke in the reef.
Call the dust pop.
We live in a society of laws.
Dust pop?
Yeah.
No, it's not real.
This thing of weed.
Takes one shot a weekend of training to get that bag.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/policeacademypodcast. With over 180,000 titles to choose from, you will have no trouble finding an audiobook to get hooked on. Your membership gets you one free book a month and a 30% discount on any additional purchases. And once you buy a book, and this is what I love about Audible, it's yours for life. That is unless you don't like it, in which case you can always return it for a different one. So go check them out by following the link in the show notes or going to audibletrial.com/policeacademypodcast. Hey guys, welcome back to Police Academy Podcast. It is my distinct privilege to introduce you to Justin Nix. He's a professor at University of Louisville. He has a PhD in criminology and criminal justice, and his research focuses particularly on police legitimacy, procedural justice, and police use of force, which are obviously all hot topics right now. In this conversation, we talk about some really interesting stuff. At least his take on what the research is showing right now is very interesting, especially when he starts talking about the fatal police shooting statistics applied to population data and what we should and shouldn't do with that type of research, what it does and does not tell us. He also has some very interesting comments on the Ferguson effect, whether it is real and what its effects are. We also talk about implicit racial bias and, again, whether that exists, what it means, what we should do about it, what research needs to do. This is the kind of conversation we should be having broadly as a society. Unfortunately, this doesn't sell in mainstream media, so I guess you just have to find it here. Justin also gives some great tips and advice as far as how to find truth when it comes to what's really going on with things like this, with policing, race, and all the stuff that's really big in the media right now, but also really missing the point, not really talking about the real issues. It's all clickbait. It's all to boost ratings. It's not really about the truth. So I hope you guys find some actual objective truth here. I know that's what I'm about, and that seems to be what Justin is about as well in conducting his research, which I appreciate very much, because without guys like him, we really wouldn't have a leg to stand on. So big shout out to Justin. And for everyone listening, if you want to get hold of him, you can find him at JNixy on Twitter. It's J-N-I-X-Y. And I will also put up links to his Google Scholar page if you want to stay in the loop on his research, and his email if you want to ask him questions or interact with him that way. And the last thing I want to say before we start is there is some audio popping, distortion, crap in this episode. It is from the Skype line. I don't know why it's there. I will figure out what's going on and fix that for future episodes. I hope you guys can just kind of grin and bear it. I am all about quality when it comes to my shows, and this drives me crazy, but it did not present itself during the interview. It only showed up afterwards. So I don't know what the heck it was doing. I will figure it out. I will fix it. But for this episode, you're just going to have to deal with it. I'm so sorry. Hope you can forgive me. Okay, that's it. Without further ado, Justin Nix. I want to start just by giving people an idea of why you do what you do. My audience generally has a pretty good idea of why I'm here. You're a professor, you're a researcher. why did you choose that career path and that focus, or at least your research focus?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when I started my undergrad at University of South Carolina, the goal was to be a police officer, preferably at the federal level.
Okay.
But around my senior year was right when the Great Recession hit and the job market was pretty rough. And in fact, we couldn't even have a career fair because too few people were willing to come set up a booth because they just weren't hiring. And one of my professors approached me and said, hey, you'd be really good for graduate school. If nothing else, do your master's in 2 years. Maybe the job market looks a little better. But, you know, once I got involved with research and projects in grad school, I really started to really love my job. And so it was natural for me to take an interest in researching the police. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this topic of police legitimacy and use of force, it's always been an important issue. But about the second or third year of my PhD studies is when it really started to capture the national sort of discourse, and just kind of fell backwards into this line of research.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely an all-time high, probably, of interest in this research. So The right place at the right time.
Yeah.
And obviously, we definitely need people like you to do this research. And I'll get to that in a minute. But what's your objective generally when you come up with a hypothesis, when you're beginning to dig into, you're asking a question, you're trying to find out, okay, you know, what's the answer to, does the Ferguson effect exist? Or what's your objective when you create those hypotheses?
So my objective broadly is to be objective, to be unbiased, and to search for the truth as best I can. You know, we'll come up with an interesting question, or we'll see a question posed in the media or by another researcher working on similar things. And, you know, if I can get my hands on some data or get access to an agency that will let me sample their officers and do a survey, you know, that's the real objective I have, is to be unbiased and present the facts as I find them. And I would say, secondly, this thing with the media, you know, having seen The Guardian and The Washington Post begin to collect better data on use of force, you know, I've seen them make statements that their data don't always support, or that, you know, they should definitely qualify a little better. And so sometimes, you know, especially of late, my objective has been to try to answer some of these questions that are not being sufficiently answered in the media. So, like, for example, the War on Cops paper that we recently published. Mm-hmm. We'd seen this narrative that there's been a war on cops, and so we went out and found some data and tried to answer that question empirically. So, you know, sometimes it's not easy to publish a finding that might not look good for the police, or vice versa. But that's always my goal, is to just shed some light on reality.
Right.
I don't have a dog in the fight, per se. You know, I'm not a police officer. I just want to know what the truth is.
Right. That's good to hear. I mean, again, my audience kind of knows where I'm at. And I think people knew coming into this platform, Police Academy, go, oh, he's a former cop, he does have a dog in the fight. But that's actually why I'm not a police officer, at least why I haven't gone back into law enforcement, because I don't want to have a dog in that fight. I want to be able to say what needs to be said. And it's good to hear, you know, from a researcher's perspective, that your objective is essentially the same as mine. Let's find out what's really going on. I mean, what you just mentioned about the Washington Post, one of the articles that you're cited in starts with one of those statements, that the way it's written makes it sound like we have definitive research that blacks are being disproportionately, it doesn't necessarily say targeted, but that is the impression that they create by the way they wrote it. So it's good to see that there are researchers that are actually looking for whether or not that's true.
Yeah, and I would just add that I assume your audience is largely law enforcement, or at least a good portion of it. But I would just hope that, you know, sometimes it's hard to, I've given presentations to police audiences, and, you know, sometimes they're skeptical of a kid who's never been a cop trying to tell them about what he's found with respect to policing. So,
right.
Again, just I'm trying to be right down the middle about it, you know.
Right. My audience is probably at this point majority civilian, actually. And that is the goal. Okay. Obviously, I welcome law enforcement officers in my audience. I want them to be involved too, because really this is about a conversation, and I have to have both sides involved. But the goal of Police Academy is to give the public, people who don't understand the culture, the training, the mindset that police have, kind of a window into that world. So it actually is geared more towards the civilian world.
Okay. And I've
already talked about my motivation, but ultimately the goal here in this interview as well as my entire platform is to find truth and to make decisions and affect positive change based on actual truth. I think the big caveat here going into this interview, this discussion that we're about to have for everyone listening, is that none of this discounts your individual experiences. If you have had bad experiences with the police, you feel like you've been treated unjustly, none of what we're going to talk about here when we're talking about research discounts your personal experience. We're talking about some larger macro issues, whether there's a systematic problem with our police force, because that's a large part of the discussion today. And to figure out if those things are real, we have to use research. We can't use individual anecdotal evidence, because that doesn't tell us anything. There are people all over the country who have had bad experiences with the police from all walks of life, all skin colors. And those anecdotal stories ultimately don't mean anything without actual objective research to back it up. So that's what this conversation is about. Again, my audience kind of knows that anytime I get on here and we talk about this kind of stuff, I'm always sympathetic to individual experiences, but we have to look at research. So let's talk about the Ferguson effect. You've done some pretty serious research on this subject, and I want to start by kind of defining what that is. So let's start with this. The Ferguson effect hypothesis suggests that officers are conscious of the negative publicity surrounding their profession, understand that their actions could be recorded by the public at any given time, and become less willing to do their job as a way to avoid being accused of racial profiling or excessive force. Generally, what have you found regarding that part of the premise of the Ferguson effect?
Yeah, so it means different things to, it kind of depends on who you ask. But starting with that definition, the idea that, and so others like former Commissioner Bratton have called it the YouTube effect or the viral video effect. So it's, you've defined it pretty well there. And we've surveyed officers in pretty big cities, metropolis areas, following Ferguson, made them feel like they were less motivated, less willing to be proactive, felt that it made it less enjoyable to have a career in law enforcement, or more dangerous to be a cop, or made them more hesitant to use force in situations where they might think it is justifiable or necessary. And we found that a good portion of our sample agreed with a lot of those statements. And so it indicates that they have been affected. And this is in an agency pretty far removed from Ferguson, the city. And I think it speaks to the fact that this is a national issue, and it affects cops all over the country, really. And I should say I've followed this research up with more work that's not been published yet in separate agencies and training academies. And I find the same thing every time, that a good portion of the samples that we draw agree with statements like these. One of the more recent questions that I've asked is, do you think that crime is going to go up because of depolicing? And a good, like, half of my sample agrees or strongly agrees with that statement.
Right. So then is the follow-up question to that, or the next potentially hypothesis that you would create for further research, is crime actually going up?
So we don't know yet. I mean, there's been the best study to date suggests that in the year following Ferguson, the shooting of Michael Brown, crime didn't appear to be going up. And when I say crime, I mean the Part 1 UCR offenses. So murder, rape, aggravated assault, robbery. the one crime that did appear to maybe be on the rise was robbery, and it was a small, you know, not a huge jump in the post-Ferguson era. But I should say that there's been another study by Rick Rosenfeld that suggests that homicides are going up, specifically homicides, but that it's really confined to a handful of major cities throughout the United States. The most recent UCR data to come out suggests that violent crime is up slightly. But then if you look at the NCVS, it suggests that crime is down. The truth is, or at least what we know, is that crime has been trending downward pretty steadily since the mid-90s.
Right.
And so it could be that it's starting to regress back to the mean. You know, we've been going down for so long. It could just be that it's, you know, we've hit the valley and it's going to start creeping back upward. Or it could be indicative of the legitimacy crisis that police find themselves in now, where the public feel more defiant and the police perhaps are less willing to be as proactive as before. And this is sort of a recipe for crime to start to creep back up. But the truth is, we can't say definitively.
How long do you think it'll be before we've got enough, you know, historical data to really have a good handle on whether, you know, what's driving the crime rate? If it, you know, so that we can see how much it's gone up and what coincides with that as far as the Ferguson effect, officers' perceptions of legitimacy, all that kind of stuff. You think 2-3 years or?
I think, yeah, at least. I mean, I think it's, even when you make year-to-year comparisons, it can be terribly misleading. I mean, if we compare 2016 to 2015, we might see an increase that's alarming, but then 2017 might be lower than what we saw in 2015. So you need to look at longer-term trends to be able to make definitive statements.
Okay. So I found it interesting, your comments about the Ferguson effect, because obviously I haven't read all of your research. But at least the way it was represented by some of the news articles and some of the stuff that I read, I kind of had the impression that you were pointing at the fact the Ferguson effect is not showing up statistically. It's not having a statistical significant impact, especially when you account for example, in the one study, the alleged Ferguson effect and the police willingness to engage in community partnership, you say that the Ferguson effect appears to exist, but when you account for the organization's organization justice and self-legitimacy, that it's rendered basically null, that it doesn't seem to exist.
Right.
So the question I have about that is, do you think the research that's going on right now is targeting the right departments? Let's step back a little bit actually and go, do you think that the assumption that departments with large poverty stricken high crime inner city areas are most likely to be affected by the Ferguson effect? Is that a good hypothesis that you think would be supported by data?
Well, so to take a step back, I mean, where this all sprang from was an op-ed written by Heather McDonald, and the title of the op-ed was "The New Nationwide Crime Wave." Mm-hmm. And, you know, having read that op-ed, it made it sound like this was, again, a national problem for police everywhere. Mm-hmm. She's since sort of toned it down a little bit, and I think that the new way of thinking about the Ferguson effect is that it would largely be restricted to cities that have had these high-profile shootings, such as St. Louis being close to Ferguson, or Chicago, or Baltimore, in places where you've seen a shooting where there's been outrage, particularly of an unarmed black male, for example, you would expect to see a pullback from the police and an increased amount of defiance and even violence by citizens who are upset over what's been going on. So, you know, we need more research to see if that's what's going on. I'll say Rosenfeld's paper suggests that the cities that are experiencing an increase in homicide tend to line up with those cities that had the high profile shootings.
I'll try to get a link from you for that research. after we're done, so I can post that with this show, so people can look at it if they want to. I guess where I'm going with that question is, I feel like a lot of times when you see this research, for example, the one I just mentioned, where you're basically saying it appears that there is a significant difference, or that the statistics do indicate there's some sort of Ferguson effect impact, but when you account for, say, a police department that does have legitimacy in the eyes of their community, that officers feel like, you know, they have proper authority, that their department is in good standing, etc., that it kind of nullifies that. And my personal experience would completely agree with that. I don't think my prior department and those officers, and especially actually having these conversations with them, is being affected at least nearly as much by this idea of a Ferguson effect as a department like Omaha, which is connected to my old department, but they've got a large inner city, high crime population, lots of gang issues. Same with a St. Louis, a Detroit, a Baltimore, any of those big cities that have those areas of the city where you've got especially the gang problems, you know, extremely high crime rates, and departments that are so big that I feel like you tend to see you tend to see the legitimacy issues, corruption issues, that kind of stuff. So what I find a lot of times when I'm looking at this research, and I'm not specifically talking about yours, is that researchers look at, or at least the media and the public look at, police as one large entity. And they look at all police data from across the country. But if we're talking about the Ferguson effect, in my humble opinion, I feel like we should be looking at places where it's most likely to exist.
Sure.
And distilling the data to places where the police are working in environments that are heavily gang infested, high black crime rates, where you were most likely to see that the effects of that of the Ferguson effect, if it doesn't in fact exist. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, that's the challenge as a researcher, is to try to get a sample that's representative of the population you're trying to speak to. And unfortunately, as you say, it often gets treated as if, you know, every police officer, no matter what department, is indicative. You know, for whatever reason, we treat cops like they're part of this fraternity, as if, you know, there's a national law enforcement body. And as you mentioned, cities are different. You know, every agency is dealing with a unique community or a set of communities. And just going back to the way that the Ferguson effect has been talked about in the media, it seems to be thrown around as if it's a national, certainly probably not just not the case. And so we need some studies that do those types of comparisons. It would be great if, you know, hopefully researchers are trying to replicate our work and do it in rural communities and do it in bigger cities, and so that we can have something to compare it to. I was at the American Society of Criminology conference last week in New Orleans, and I didn't get a chance to catch it, but I saw that there was a presentation about depolicing in agencies throughout Missouri. And so I'm eager to see what becomes of that. The truth is, and this will sound like a cop-out, is that we need more data, more research.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to the Ferguson effect, one thing that research does not have to answer, in my opinion, is that there are certainly officers, and not just a few, throughout the country who are consciously making a decision to change the way they do their job because of the fear that if something happens, they're going to essentially, this isn't a professional term, but be thrown under the bus, so to speak, by, you know, a video that someone shoots that doesn't fairly represent the entire encounter, because they've seen guys like Darren Wilson and Ferguson essentially lose their career, if not their freedom, in a lot of ways. And that had nothing to do with video, but, you know, it's called the Ferguson effect for a reason. That's kind of the case study for this phenomenon. So the idea that when we talk about, does it exist? It certainly exists in individual police officers. I don't think there's any question about that. It's, if anything, what is it having an effect on crime rates? You know, what effect is it having on our society and policing at large?
So that's the key question. Is, I think, in conversations I've had anecdotally with police officers, really from all over the country, they've been affected by this, and they believe their colleagues have been affected by this. They do feel less motivated, but at the end of the day, is that going to result in more crime, or is it even going to result in depolicing? Right. I mean, yeah, maybe they feel less motivated. Maybe they find it a little harder to go the extra mile and do that, you know, that not aggressive, but that proactive stop. But do they still do it? I mean, maybe it's a little harder, but at the end of the day, are they still answering calls and doing their job? I think probably so, for the most part. And even if we could establish that there's depolicing going on, is that going to automatically mean that crime's going to go up? That's a stretch. You know, it's very hard to explain trends in crime. It could be due to a number of factors. And so to say that Ferguson and negative publicity has produced depolicing and crime's already starting to go up because police are pulling back, I think there's a lot of assumptions going on there, and it's just not supported by the data so far.
Let's move on to the statistics that we now have, which is really interesting, about fatal police shootings. And the Washington Post started collecting this data after Ferguson. So they have the only entire year that we have at this point when it comes to racial statistics applied to fatal police shootings is from 2015. Mm-hmm. And it's shocking to many to realize that our government hasn't been tracking this, and that it took a news organization essentially to actually collect this data. But that's the case. And I think if anything good has come out of where we're at now as a country, especially in the debate about police and race and all that, it's okay, let's really figure out what's going on. Let's actually, you know, let's collect the data that we need to figure out if there are issues there. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think the conversation as a whole isn't really about the data. And people typically aren't patient enough to wait for actual research to, you know, come out and disprove or prove what they already believe. And the media is not helping there, but so the Washington Post collected this data, and in 2015, of fatal police shootings, 50% of the victims were white, 26% were black, 17% were Hispanic. And the big debate there when it comes to whether blacks are disproportionately targeted by the police or disproportionately shot and killed by the police is that blacks represent 13% of the population, but they represent 26% of fatal police shootings. And the argument typically doesn't go any deeper than, well, cops shoot twice as many white people. Yeah, but blacks only represent 13% of the population, and they're shot at 26%, so they're twice as, you know, likely to get shot. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't go any deeper than that.
Right.
But so the question is, are blacks shot at disproportionate rates? And I think the clear answer is yes. And stop me if you disagree or if I'm missing a statistic anywhere here, but are they shot at disproportionate rates by population? Yes, clearly. Mm-hmm. Or at least they were in 2015. Mm-hmm. But the assumption that a lot of people in the media are pointing at is, well, it's because of race. And the question for you and for other researchers is, what is really driving those statistics? Why is there, where's that disproportionality coming from?
Right.
And so you look at violent crime rates, arrest rates, black arrest rates specifically, and I'll let you kind of touch on that. Where are we at as far as understanding how and if violent crime rates are driving this disproportionality with, you know, the police use of force on black Americans? What research have you done on that, and what have you seen on that?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I would start by saying that, you know, using the population as a benchmark is terribly misleading, and it really tells us nothing about whether there's bias in the police decision to use force. So first and foremost, I guess it's worth pointing out that just because the Washington Post has compiled data on fatal shootings, that does not mean, in fact, we don't know how often the police use deadly force. So if a cop shoots and misses, or if a cop shoots and wounds but does not kill a suspect, these are still cases where the cop has used deadly force.
Right.
And a recent analysis of 10 years of data in St. Louis on all police shootings, fatal or non-fatal, found that the suspect only died about 16% of the time.
So there's a huge data set we're missing.
We're missing anywhere from, and if that were to hold up on the national level, it would mean we're missing about 84% of the shootings. More conservative estimates say that the suspect might die, you know, 20 or 30% of the time. But in any event, we're still missing anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 instances in which the police use deadly force, but we don't know about it because the suspect didn't die. Mm-hmm. So the Post have provided us with the most reliable data that we have to date, because there are problems with, you know, the FBI's data with official sources. But it's still, we have to still be truthful with ourselves about what it is. It's still only a piece of the pie. And so we have to qualify all statements that we make, myself included, with using that data, with the fact that we're still missing several thousand shootings. Mm-hmm. And with that, we're missing the race of the suspects involved and the context involved in each shooting and so forth. So that's number one. And then number two is to take these numbers, these incomplete numbers, and to standardize them against the population is just misleading, you know, because if black citizens come into contact with cops more often, then they're exposed to the opportunity to have force used against them more often. Mm-hmm. And that's where people bring in the question of crime or arrests, you know, what would be a better benchmark? And I would certainly say that, yeah, arrests are probably a better benchmark than strictly looking at the population. But I think what you would find, assuming we had some complete data on both crime rates and on police shootings, is that we might see racial bias, but I don't know that we'd see it at the decision to use force. I think it might occur earlier in the process. So maybe the police are more likely to stop a black citizen, mm-hmm. or question and search a black citizen, or arrest a black citizen, at which point presumably there's the opportunity for the citizen to resist and for force to need to be applied to gain compliance.
Right.
So it's my belief that there may be bias going on earlier in the process, and we need to be truthful with ourselves about that that's maybe what's going on. I think at the decision to use force, at least my own research and some places where I've done it, there doesn't appear to be police bias. So I don't know if I answered your question at all there.
No, I think that's you answered it as well as you could have, considering it was a terrible question. I was kind of grappling there. I've got a whole bunch of statistics in front of me, mm-hmm. and I don't want to just throw statistics out there. Mm-hmm. But that does answer the question, because I think the simple thing for people to do is cite the statistics that I already mentioned. This is mm-hmm. the percent of the population. This is the percent of fatal police shootings, and mm-hmm. and not go any further. And it's not necessarily anyone's individual fault. That's people still trust the media for some reason. And mm-hmm. that's what they're being fed.
Right.
And especially on social media, then that's a whole different story. But again, we're being fed what we want to hear.
Yeah,
we're not ultimately, you can find the truth if you're willing to look for it. But if you don't go any deeper than what your friends on Facebook share and what your favorite news source is telling you, you're not actually getting any real information. So,
no,
that answers the question really well. I do have a couple questions based on that, though. Is anyone currently collecting data on all police shootings, all deadly force incidents now? Do you know?
I don't know. I'm sure that there are. It would be an incredibly difficult undertaking, just because, you know, there are 18,000 police departments in this country, and that would require quite a Google alert to try to hit on all the different local newspapers that would, you know, A, discover that a shooting occurred, and then B, report on it. It'd be a monumental task. I'm sure, and I'm optimistic that somebody's doing that research, but I'm not aware of who it might be.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. It's great that the Washington Post collected the fatal shooting data. But like you said, if we are really serious about answering these questions, especially when it comes to deadly force, we have to look at deadly force. I mean, just because somebody dies doesn't really has nothing to do with the officer's intentions, because if they're using deadly force, let's be honest, the intention is to end that person's life.
Yes.
The police officers, we're all taught this line that it's deadly force is to stop the threat. Well, that means kill them.
Yes.
So just because somebody doesn't die really has nothing to do with their intent. And if we're looking at biases, that speaks to intent. So I hope somebody's collecting that, because if we're looking for truth, we need that data. Maybe you can start doing that.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, we often as researchers are forced to do is look at a single city or look at maybe a dozen cities, wherever we can really get access to the data. Right. And I'll give Houston a shout out. They're very transparent with their data, and it's publicly available on all shootings. And so if more agencies did that, we'd be able to do more, more detailed research, I suppose, you know, because if we do a study of 12 agencies, it's easy to say, well, do those 12 agencies represent the 18,000 that police our country? And the answer is probably not. So we're often forced to sort of make sacrifices and do the best that we can, and it's not enough. So criminologists have been imploring the federal government for decades to collect better data, and it still hasn't happened. And so they've got to come up with a way to incentivize more local and state agencies to send their data in so that we can answer these important questions.
Right. The other question, I had when you're talking about the idea that, or your suspicion that implicit biases might affect decisions earlier on in the process, whether it's the decision to stop and frisk somebody, to to stop that car, to take an encounter further. I personally. And I wrote a little article on this. I've put some content on this, but this isn't empirical at all. It's more intellectual, philosophical, so to speak. But I personally believe that the question of the existence of implicit bias is silly. Clearly, as human beings and fundamentally as animals with survival instincts, we all have bias. Mm-hmm. We all see each other differently based on, you know, our upbringing, our experiences, the way the media influences us when it comes to police officers, our training. We all see our differences, and whether we realize it or not, whether we're intentional about treating everyone fairly, there are decisions being made before they reach the conscious level based on all those things I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? Does that make sense? Do you agree on that fundamental level, or?
Yeah, I agree. And the research supports those statements, is that it isn't a question of does it exist. It exists. We all have implicit biases. The question is, are those biases borne out with respect to race and the use of force, or race and arrest rates?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're just starting to sort of tap into that sort of research that tries to tease those questions out. But there have been studies, and we referenced some of them in the paper that got covered by the Washington Post, that have, you know, given participants a quick image of a black or a white face, and then a quick image of either a gun or some other object like a hammer or a screwdriver. And then the participants are asked to, within half of a second, press a shoot or a don't shoot button based on whether you saw a gun or some other object. And what we see is that, or not what we see, I didn't do the research, but what researchers have found is that people are more likely to mistake an object as a gun when they saw a black face as opposed to a white face. And they're quicker to decide to shoot in instances where there was a gun if they've been primed with a black face as opposed to a white face. And so by forcing participants to do it within half a second, you're forcing them to rely on their unconscious information processing system. So we, not to get too technical on the what implicit bias means, but it's, you know, our minds are bombarded with information on a daily basis. And we have two levels of information processing to try to make more sense of it. So we have a sort of a quick, unconscious, effortless level one way of thinking where we associate heuristics and make connections outside of our conscious awareness. And then there's the level two, which is more mentally taxing and more effort is required to think through and make these connections. And so by forcing the participants to make that decision in half of a second, you're forcing them to rely on unconscious information processing. And so if we see that race or the color of a person's skin influences the extent to which mistakes are made or the how quick the trigger is pulled, you know, so to speak, the button is pressed, that's evidence that there's some unconscious racial bias there. And that's not, I feel like sometimes implicit bias, people think that it's like a safe word to say, you know, cops aren't racist, but they're implicitly biased. Like that's a nicer way to say it. No, I mean, it's a human bias that we all have to some extent. And right. So it's just that the police, given the powers that they have, you know, it's something that we need to know more about so that that bias isn't affecting criminal justice related outcomes for citizens.
Right. Well, that's an interesting statement because I don't know that we will ever be able or this is difficult. If I, you know, I put myself in the shoes of a young black American and understand from as well as I can how they look at this and go, well, that sucks because if I'm more likely to get shot mistakenly, even though I'm a completely upstanding, you know, law-abiding citizen, well, I want that to change. Mm-hmm. On the same token, I don't know if we'll ever be able to at least completely. I assume this is one of the research questions that will be asked or already has been, but, you know, how can we kind of counteract or fight that bias and try to negate it as much as possible? At the same time, if the bias, we call it implicit bias, in a lot of ways, you can let me know if you agree or disagree, but I feel like another way to describe it is survival instincts. We're taking past experiences, information that we've seen in our lives, and using that subconsciously, our brain is going, okay, last time I dealt with this type of a situation, this is what happened, and if I want to live, I need to react this way versus that way. So, one of the questions that I have been asking myself recently is, okay, if the bias is based on a real thing, for example, that an officer is more likely to get shot and killed in, you know, inner city Detroit in the middle of gangland versus suburban, you know, West Omaha. If that is true, then is it prudent to remove that bias if it is actually a survival instinct? That's a really tough ethical question to me. What do you think about that?
I don't know that we could ever, at least definitely not overnight, remove the bias. It's more about trying to increase awareness about it. So yes, a cop might draw on past experiences and he might think, you know, the last time I dealt with a young black male in inner city Detroit, it ended this way. I mean, that doesn't mean that the next time you deal with a young black male in Detroit, it's going to end similarly. But that's that level one processing. That's that quick mental association that you've made unconsciously. Right. And so the idea is, how do we at the same time balance officer safety with increasing awareness about not acting on those unconscious biases? So it's about raising awareness. And Dr. Lori Friedel at the University of South Florida does a lot of training for agencies on increasing awareness of implicit and unconscious biases. So you might look at some of the stuff that she's done with those trainings. Secondly, I do want to point out that there's been research that suggests the opposite might be true. So rather than police being implicitly biased, maybe they're counter-biased. Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting paper in criminology and public policy by some researchers out at Washington State University. And they put police officers in a realistic video simulator where they're in a room interacting with a large video screen. They have a realistic Glock that they're armed with that emits a laser, and it sends signals for how long it took the officer to pull the trigger. And what they found was that officers were, in fact, more hesitant to shoot when the suspect they were dealing with was black. They actually took a few milliseconds longer to pull the trigger. And so the title of the paper is The Reverse Racism Effect. And so they can only speculate about why that was the case. But they offer that it's because in this legitimacy crisis era, in this post-Ferguson era, cops are worried about the backlash that could result from their agency, from the media, from the public, if they were to mistakenly shoot an unarmed black person. And so they call this the counter bias effect. And it's interesting because those realistic simulators, I mean, yes, officers are making split second decisions, but it's not half a second like it is in those picture trials I told you about. And so they're able to maybe counteract those implicit biases that they probably still have, but they're able to process the scene, process what's going on, and exert more hesitance or take a little longer to decide whether the trigger needs to be pulled or not. And we're talking milliseconds, but that can be the difference between life and death. So that was kind of the motivation for our study with the post data. It was like, all right, well, we have these picture trials, we have this simulation data, but what at the end of the day, what happens in the real world? And now that we've got this best data that we've ever had, maybe we can answer some key questions. But to answer your question, no, I don't think we can remove bias, but I'm encouraged by what the Washington State researchers found, and I'm encouraged by the work that Dr. Lori Friedel is doing on increasing bias awareness. And so some things that you might do is, and some things that we offer in our paper is positive intergroup contact. So all too often police are only coming in contact with people who've either committed a crime or are suspected of committing a crime. And so they're sort of coming into contact with people who've engaged in some level of deviance. Mm-hmm. And so we need to try as best we can to get cops exposed to white and black citizens not involved in deviance. And so going back to community policing and doing neighborhood barbecues or basketball tournaments, school resource, programs, have the cops come into contact with minority youth who aren't committing crimes to maybe offset some of that implicit bias. Or there's an explosion of research that's been done in recent decades on procedural fairness. I'm sure you've heard of the term. When police officers treat citizens respectfully, when they give them a voice, when they explain the reasons that they're making their decisions, people are more trusting of the police. And so if we emphasize procedural fairness training, and if we can come up with a way to make sure officers strive to use it at every opportunity, over time, citizens and communities will have more trust in the police. And that's a good thing, because when they're more trusting of the police, they accept their decisions, they comply, they cooperate. It's just better for everybody involved. Police will in turn become more trusting of citizens, and it's sort of a cycle of benefit.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good point and a very simple thing to change. You see these videos where the police are telling somebody to do something, and I understand from the officer's perspective, sometimes in the midst of an incident, your objective is, okay, I need to de-escalate, separate parties. Mm-hmm. I need something to happen, and it's not necessarily because I'm trying to arrest this person or violate their rights or anything like that. It's just let's get things calmed down and really distill the issue down, figure out what the real problem is. But in the mm-hmm. process, it's, am I being detained? Am I being arrested? You're getting these questions thrown at you. And in the moment, it's like, you're still processing the incident, and you don't want to say yes. You're being arrested because you're still investigating it. So I understand where officers often find themselves not being able to answer that question. So I think I agree in the sense that we definitely need to be training officers. Number one, answer the question. Give them something. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just, no, you are not being arrested, but right now for scene security, I need you to do this. You are not under arrest at this time, and it's hard because civilians don't understand the difference between like a de facto arrest and an official arrest. Technically, yes, you're being arrested temporarily because the police are not allowed. It's like you're being detained, and at the level of, no, you do have to do what I tell you to do. It doesn't mean you're going to jail. Right now, technically, yes, you cannot leave. You're detained. It might even rise to the level of a de facto arrest, but you're not being charged with anything. But to explain that in the moment is difficult. So
it is. And I mean, I think, officers arrive on scene and they don't know, they often are working with limited information that they've gotten from dispatch, who may have gotten it from a caller who doesn't know who the person that they're calling about is. They see some behavior, they call the police. Police arrive, and their first concern always is officer safety, right? Get the situation under control. But I've heard this this acronym AMT, ask, make, tell. Have you heard of this?
Ask, tell, make. Yep.
And nowhere in there is there any explanation. And so all too often, I think things escalate where it doesn't need to, because the citizen doesn't immediately comply, and then it becomes sort of a contest to see all right, well, now I'm telling you, and if you still don't want to comply, then I'm going to have to make you. And so there are a lot of these critical incidents that unfortunately elevate to force and to deadly force, where maybe it could have been diffused through a simple explanation. And I know it's not always that easy. If officers are dealing with multiple suspects and they've got an audience and maybe they don't have as much backup as they like, it's a difficult job, and I don't pretend to understand, how those different nuances work. But at every juncture, if they could just really focus on those elements of procedural justice, I think they get more back from the citizen, more compliance.
Sure. Yeah. And I asked tell make, that is actually what I used, I'd been taught several different things, and I found that to be the most reliable and effective at keeping myself and my coworkers and the people I was dealing with safe while being fair. The thing that I'll mention about that is that if you just look at the name, ask, tell, make, nothing in there includes explain. So maybe it needs to be ask, explain, tell, make. I don't know. But if you're trained correctly, the explanation is still part of it. It's part of the ask. Hey, I need, can you please blah, 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 because yada, yada. Sure. And oftentimes you don't have to, because people are like, yeah, sure. But you start getting pushback, and it's, hey, I need you to do this because of this.
Right.
Do this now, or it moves on past explain, because a lot of times, as any officer listening to this really, really understands at a fundamental level, you can explain all you want, it's not going to matter. But it is still, I think, officer's duty to at least try one time to say, hey, this is why. You know, if you don't agree with the explanation, this is not the venue, but I'm going to give you at least that opportunity to understand why I want you to do this. So I'm going to ask you and hopefully explain clearly why I need you to do this. Then I'm going to tell you, and in that tell, it's you need to, or this is going to happen. You need to do this or you're going to be arrested. And then do it. It's like raising kids. You've got to enforce. You've got to back up what you say. And when officers don't, that is when they get hurt. That is when the the civilian ends up getting hurt because you linger in that I'm telling you to do something or else mode, and it lets the person you're dealing with, if they're not going to cooperate, figure out how they're going to fight back. Right. And that's a really bad thing. And I think the thing that officers are dealing with right now is, well, I don't want to go into the make mode too soon because of how that will be perceived, even right. though we know that the sooner you and the higher level of force you use quicker, I guess is what I'm trying to say, the less likely someone is going to get hurt. That doesn't mean excessive force. Yeah. But if you try to use padded handcuffs, so to speak, you try to be too gentle and too soft in a situation where someone is planning on fighting back, it increases the chances that you're going to get hurt or they're going to get hurt or even killed. So long-winded, and I went on a tangent explanation of there should be, if you're an officer operating under the ask, tell, make, there should be a part in there where you're explaining what you're doing. And if there isn't, change what you're doing.
Well, and I think an important point is that the explanation needs to be more than I'm giving you a lawful order or, you know, because I'm a cop and I told you so, right? It's, absolutely. You know, people often want to know, particularly when they haven't committed a crime, right? When there's just suspicion of a crime, but there's been no wrongdoing. A natural question for a person is, hey, man, why are you stopping me? You know, I've not done anything wrong. And it's you have to explain and you have to give the citizen a chance to participate in the conversation.
Right.
And you have to appear neutral. You know, as we saw with Stop and Frisk, it seemed that was the way that played out is that it disproportionately targeted minority citizens.
Right.
And so people come away feeling as if the police aren't neutral. They're out looking for people who look like me. And that doesn't feel very fair to us. And people rightfully so get upset about it. And so it's difficult things for individual officers to navigate. But it's, again, I just go back to harping on it, is that police really have to try to strive to do that, because the research unquestionably supports, you know, the notion that people will be more accepting and cooperative and compliant when they get that. And it's, again, it's not an overnight fix, although within an individual interaction, it's likely to get better results. But certainly if the police operate this way over time, and it'll build a, Tom Tyler calls it, a self-regulatory society, where people will voluntarily obey the law because they think it's legitimate. They think police are legitimate.
Yeah, that would be an awesome thing to have, a society that regulates itself, and be a lot less work for the police and a lot safer. Is there anything else? We're kind of getting to the end of the notes here, so anything else that you just want to hit on as, you know, we're kind of rounding out this conversation?
You know, it's difficult, right? Because people sort of, they watch the news sources that they, you know, they want to watch what's going to tell them what they want to hear, you know, and like you say, the sharing the memes on Facebook, it just turns my hair gray. But something that I tell all of my classes is, like, you know, obviously you're here to get an education, and, you know, but more so than just trying to learn what I'm telling you, I wish people could do better at seeking out the truth and knowing where to go for reliable information. Like, not just accepting, you know, what some newspaper says, but going and doing some digging for yourself. I mean, the UCR is publicly available. People can go download crime statistics like you've done. Now that the Post is collecting those shootings, you know, you can look at what they've found. You can click on each case and read the article about it and decide whether you agree that the Post might say that person posed an imminent threat. Well, maybe you disagree. It's people need to educate themselves, but more than that, they need to know how to educate themselves. And sometimes that's hard. It's hard to weed through all of the BS sometimes and get at the truth.
Right.
And, you know, so the old saying goes, we have to acknowledge that we don't know what we don't know. Right. And so telling you what I've told you about the Post data and about deadly force, we just have to be upfront about the fact that that's still incomplete data. And so we can't make these broad-based conclusions. At the end of the day, we don't know. I saw FBI Director James Comey was quoted at the IACP conference as saying something along the lines of, we don't know whether the number of black or brown citizens being shot is on the rise because we haven't collected the data. And I think the average citizen reads that and gets frustrated and says, well, why isn't the director of the FBI collecting the data? It's not that simple. But there's some truth in his statement. We don't know. We don't have any national data that would allow us to make a claim like that. So I don't know, advice. I mean, I would implore, as many before me have done, for the government to figure out a way to collect and store this data. And then for people to, you know, to not rush to conclusions when, you know, inevitably another shooting happens and it, you know, it gets a lot of media coverage. I don't know where I was going with that, but just, well, to always in search of the truth and not just what you want to hear, you know? Right. I mean,
You're going with that. I mean,
for me, it's like I approach everything trying to be objective. As I said, I don't have a dog in the fight. You know, I just want to know, hey, what's the truth? And I feel people all too often go into this wanting to find something that reaffirms what they already believe. And that's, we're never going to get anywhere if we keep doing that.
Right. And really, that's, I feel like where you're going with that is the media is showing you what, ultimately, what is going to make them money. It's about ratings. And what drives that is what people are interested in, what they click on, what they watch, what they want to hear. So as individuals, if you're looking for, if you're watching CNN, you're watching Fox, any mainstream media, you need to take everything you see with a grain of salt.
Yes.
Especially on the YouTube platform, there's a lot of discussion there, and I get this all the time. The question or the comments about, well, if that guy was white, he'd be alive. How can we never see white guys get shot in situations like this? And my answer is always, because the media doesn't show you. Because if you want to know, you can find the videos of a white guy getting shot in the same types of situations that black guys are getting shot. It's just, the media is not going to make any money on it, so they're not going to show you.
And I'll take it a step further and say, you know, to that point, it's easy to only see the bad, you know, to see these shootings and to hear it talked about in the news and see it talked about on Facebook and Twitter, you know, but there's also every day, there's a lot of good examples of great police work being done and of officers de-escalating situations and going the extra mile to do good for the community, right? Because they're public servants. And I'm an optimist, but I do believe that most police officers are out just trying to make the world a better place and do their job. And, you know, so I'm on Twitter and I follow a lot of major city police departments, and they often tweet out, you know, kudos about officer so-and-so, you know, helping this little kid get a pair of shoes to get this, you know, and there's so many good examples of police work out there, but we don't see it. And we sort of, it's easy to get discouraged by only constantly seeing these negative encounters in the news. And so maybe another piece of advice for your audience is to find a way to go out and find some good news to read about too, right? So that we don't get too discouraged, because there's just every day there's countless examples of police doing it the right way and going above and beyond, but that doesn't get reported on quite as often.
Right. And I think my personal experience with that is sometimes you have to break the rules to do the good thing and the right thing. I personally did that in a few cases as an officer where, you know, policy says you can't let someone, you got to tow the car if they're suspended and they don't have another driver on scene. Well, you know what? I don't really want to tow this pregnant mother of four's minivan right now because she didn't know her license was suspended, whatever the case may be. And I'm breaking policy by letting her call someone to come get the car so she can legally drive away from the scene. Completely breaking the rules, but because I'm a human and I feel I have empathy for this other person. It's not, I'm not a robot. I can put myself in the shoes of, if that were my wife, what would I do? Or, you know, letting a homeless guy, I actually did this, which is crazy. I let a homeless guy spend the night at my house, and then I bought him a bus ticket to where he was from, which I think it was North Carolina, and sent him on his way the next day. But I had to break a bunch of rules to do that and never told anyone about it because I'd be in trouble with my department and people would think I was crazy. But cops do that stuff all the time, and it's never even going to get into the media because they're not telling anybody. They're just, it's just part of their job. That's why they became cops.
And it's too easy for us to become sort of desensitized to the point where it's like, that's what we expect. You know, you turn on the news and expect to see another deadly shooting. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's an unarmed black citizen, and it's awful. And, you know, of course those things are going to get reported on, but we have to remind ourselves that it's still statistically speaking, and if you just look at how many, I don't even know how many interactions occur between the police and the citizens in this country on a daily basis, it's a very, very, very small number that results in the death of a citizen. So we have to remind ourselves, you know, it's easy to get up on a soapbox and say we need police reform and we need better training, and cops are, you know, based on the news I've seen, cops are out of control and we need to wrangle them back in. No, it's, you know, that's most of the time these things end peacefully and cops do a good job, but we have to maybe do better about reminding ourselves of that.
Right. And I think without having hard data to back this up, I do believe as a police force, and again, police, every department is different, but broadly, our police force in the United States is probably the best trained, the least corrupt force we've ever had. We're constantly progressing. Because I see the training from the inside, we're constantly trying to be better. Mm-hmm. And the perception is, in a lot of ways, the opposite based on media coverage. And people just need to realize it's not all what it seems. If you're basing your perspective on, you know, what you're seeing on CNN, it's, or, you know, I'm not singling out CNN, any big media.
Right.
Realize that they've got an ulterior motive, and that is to make money. They're a business. So,
yes.
As far as if people want to find your research or get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that? Is ResearchGate good for finding all of your stuff? I found a bunch of your articles on that.
Yeah. Not all of my stuff. I mean, okay. So there are publisher agreements and so forth. And often we're allowed to post like the pre-published version. Or the accepted version, but not the final published version to that site.
Okay.
You know, I've got the paper that was quote about a post should become available online anytime now. And so maybe the best way to do it is to go to Google Scholar and type in my name, and you can see what I've published there. And sometimes it'll be free. Sometimes it might be paywalled. But people can certainly feel free to shoot me an email and ask about research that I've done. And I'm happy to speak with them or share my work with them.
Okay.
And so you can find me at my university's webpage. One thing I'll mention, I assume you knew, but maybe not. You know, one of the reasons I was recommended for this interview is that I'm actually coming out to Nebraska, Omaha in the fall. Mm-hmm. So I'm at Louisville until the end of the spring semester. And then next fall, I'll be starting at Nebraska, Omaha. So
okay.
My contact information will change.
Okay. Do you have an email that won't change that people can use, or is like a personal one that you'll keep?
Yeah, I'll be able to have, for a few months, I'll be able to have that email forwarded to my new account. And you know, you'll be able to, again, if you go to Google Scholar, my information will be updated.
Okay.
You know, but for now it's firstname.lastname@louisville.edu. And, okay.
I'll link that in the episode. So people can, you can look at the show notes and see that, mm-hmm. His current email.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, you're coming to Omaha. That's sweet. Maybe we'll have to sit down in person once you're in town and have another discussion in the future.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Maybe I can get Eskridge on that time. He's dodging me. He's dodging me. He's sending me his minions to talk to instead of letting me talk to him. So, but he promised that you guys, he gave me a few contacts and he said you would all be better to talk to than him. So take him at his word at that. And obviously, you know, you've been a great guest. Love to have the discussion with someone who is steeped in the research and knows, you know, understands what the research means. I think that's a big missing link right now in the debate overall. What, you know, there's research out there and it may be objective, but the way it's portrayed is not necessarily. So people need to take it with a grain of salt and talk to people that are smart in actually doing the research, like Justin. So thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it very much, my friend.
Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap for this one, ladies and gents. Huge shout out to Justin Nix, University of Louisville, for spending an hour and a half with me on the mic just talking about this stuff. And shout out to you guys if you're still listening. Thanks for sticking it out. I hope this was a good interview, that it was interesting for you, that you learned a lot. And if you have questions for Justin, he is at jnixy, J-N-I-X-Y on Twitter. And I'll link his email as well. And obviously, you can always get a hold of me at policeacademypodcast@gmail.com. If you want to see future and further interviews like this one, and you have a particular subject or interviewee that you would like on the show, let me know and I'll try to make it happen. I love doing these interviews. I love having the conversation with people who are part of the solution, part of finding the answers to these very important, very difficult questions. So shoot me an email if you have suggestions. And as always, thank you guys for listening. You are awesome. Whether you're going into the weekend, the week, a night, morning, wherever you find yourself, as always, do good, be strong, fear nothing. This is Police Academy.